You're listening to DTFHN for February 15th, 2026. I'm your vacuum sealed host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who hate complexity keep building more of it. Today's got that particular energy where everything old turns out to be smarter than everything new. Let's get into it. Jonathan Mahler has been pulling at this thread, and what he found is revealing. On Linux, you want a C compiler. You type a command, you get a compiler. On Windows, you type install Visual Studio, and you've just signed up for a choose-your-own-adventure book, where most endings involve re-imaging your OS. The numbers are striking in their precision. 15 gigabytes downloaded to get a 50-megabyte compiler, a GUI installer with hundreds of checkboxes where missing one.
Say Windows 10 SDK 10 about 17.763. Or Spectre mitigated libs.
Means your build fails 3 hours later with a cryptic error code. And even after all that, compiling a single C file from the command line requires finding something called the developer command prompt, which invokes a batch script that mutates your environment variables just to locate where the compiler is hiding this week. Run this forward 5 years. Every open source project that lists install Visual Studio as a build requirement is effectively outsourcing its contributor experience to Microsoft's installer team. Maintainers become unpaid tech support, triaging GitHub issues that have nothing to do with their code and everything to do with which checkboxes someone did or didn't check. The friction compounds, contributors bounce, the project's Windows support quietly atrophies. What Mahler built is a standalone toolchain resolver that pulls exactly the components you need. The actual compiler, the actual linker, the actual SDK headers, without the 50 gigabyte IDE wrapped around them. It's the kind of solution that seems obvious in retrospect, which is usually a sign that the original problem was being framed wrong. We weren't asking how do we make Visual Studio easier to install, we were asking the wrong question entirely. The right question was why does compiling a C program require an IDE at all? The comments are instructive here, multiple people point out that workarounds exist. Unattended install scripts, Docker containers, MinGW, but workarounds are not solutions, they're evidence of the problem's shape. When an ecosystem generates that many escape hatches, the room itself is the issue. This is what happens when a toolchain is architected as a monolith rather than a composable set of tools. The compiler, the editor, the SDK, the debugger. All tangled into a single distribution that can only be installed as a unit. Compare that to any Unix system where each tool is independent, versionable, and replaceable. The difference isn't capability. Both compile the same code. The difference is architecture. One trusts developers to compose their own environment. The other decides for them. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. Sometimes the fix is just unbundling what should never have been bundled in the first place. So who's actually doing the work of documenting all those independent composable tools? Story 2, the Arch Wiki maintainers. Not the most trafficked, not the most monetized, the most genuinely practically valuable. I'd argue it's not a product page, not a social feed, not even a search engine. It might be a wiki maintained by volunteers who use Arch Linux. The Arch Wiki is one of those rare resources that makes you reconsider what documentation can be, and the engineering principle underneath it is worth examining. Most software documentation is written by the people who built the software. That sounds logical until you realize the failure mode. Developers document what they designed, not what users encounter. The gap between how this was intended to work and how do I actually make this work on my machine at 2 a.m. is enormous. The Arch Wiki closes that gap because its contributors are the users. They're writing from the trenches, not the tower. But here's where I want to play devil's advocate for a moment. You could argue that a distro-specific wiki shouldn't be the de facto documentation for all of Linux. That's a failure of upstream projects to document their own software properly, right? If every project maintained its own comprehensive docs, we wouldn't need a third-party wiki to explain how email clients work. And yet, that argument collapses on contact with reality. Arch's philosophy of staying close to upstream, of not patching things into unrecognizable configurations, means the ArchWiki accidentally became distribution agnostic. A Debian user, a Fedora user, even someone running NixOS can land on an ArchWiki page about Pulse Audio or systemd timers and walk away with exactly what they needed. The wiki works precisely because Arch doesn't heavily modify the software it packages. Minimal intervention at the distro level produced maximum utility at the documentation level. That's an elegant accident of architecture. Edward Snowden called it out a few years back. Search results have become garbage for basically everything except the Arch Wiki. That's not hyperbole. It's an observation about what survives when the commercial web optimizes for engagement over accuracy. The Arch Wiki optimizes for neither. It optimizes for being correct. One commenter raised the specter of data loss, pointing to the Gentoo Wiki incident as a cautionary tale. A burning of a small Alexandria. That's the real vulnerability here. This is community infrastructure that millions depend on, maintained by volunteers, funded by donations. The craft on display is extraordinary. Thousands of pages, meticulously cross-referenced, kept current across years of kernel releases and config format changes. This is how open knowledge is supposed to work. People contributing what they know so others don't have to rediscover it alone. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. Sometimes the most radical act is just writing it down clearly. So what happens when the thing worth preserving isn't documentation, but an entire era of creative expression? Story 3. 200,000 Flash games and animations, preserved in a single archive. Let me use an analogy from paleontology to frame why this matters. When a species goes extinct, we don't just lose the animal, we lose every behavior, every symbiosis, every ecological relationship it participated in. The fossil record captures bones, not birdsong. Flash is the birdsong of the early web. Flashpoint Archive has done something genuinely remarkable here. They've captured over 200,000 pieces of interactive culture that were never designed to outlast the platform they ran on. Flash games were ephemeral by nature. Built by teenagers in bedrooms, hosted on sites that no longer exist, played in browsers that no longer support them. One commenter found animations they made at 13, another discovered their game in the archive username misspelled, suggesting the painstaking manual curation involved in assembling this collection. The ecological metaphor runs deep. Flash wasn't just a technology, it was an entire creative ecosystem. The barrier to entry was absurdly low. A kid with a pirated copy of Macromedia Flash and a Newgrounds account could ship a game to millions. No App Store review, no monetization strategy, no analytics dashboard tracking engagement metrics, just creation for the sake of creation, distributed freely. One commenter watches their nephew navigate the modern mobile game landscape. Swatting ads, refusing premium upgrades, wading through what they accurately describe as shallow, glossy muck. The contrast is devastating. Flash games were often crude, sometimes brilliant, always free in the deepest sense. Today's mobile games are polished, optimized, and fundamentally extractive. The irony that most major mobile game genres trace their lineage directly back to Flash prototypes deserves a moment of genuine reflection. The Ruffle project, which re-implements Flash in WebAssembly, is the engine that makes this archive accessible without installing legacy software. It's open source, community-driven, and still working through the enormous surface area of ActionScript 3 compatibility. The fact that missing net connection support blocks multiplayer games from working shows just how much complexity Flash contained beneath its reputation as a simple animation tool. This is digital preservation at its most essential, not preserving what was commercially valuable. Preserving what was culturally alive, 200,000 fossils. And unlike paleontology, these ones still sing when you press play. From preserving the old web to pushing the new terminal, pause. Let's talk about making your command line genuinely beautiful. Let me walk through what we're actually looking at. A GitHub account that's 4 days old, a Hacker News user with no history. And the kicker, the Git commits in the repo are authored by a different person entirely. The top comment calls it out directly. This isn't a show HN, this is a show GPT. And look, the project itself, Perlin noise in the terminal. Oh. It is a genuinely fun idea. Half block characters for double vertical resolution. That's a clever trick. Using the upper half block to pack two color values into one terminal cell, foreground and background, effectively doubling your pixel grid. Multi-octave noise with configurable scale and speed. Four color themes. Clean signal handling on exit. There's real craft in the concept. But that's exactly the problem. The craft is in the concept. And the concept probably came from a prompt. The implementation is competent but generic. The README reads like it was extruded from a template. Feature bullets, usage flags, emoji section headers, no screenshots, no video. Multiple commenters asked for visual proof and got nothing. Someone running it on a 320 by 90 Kitty terminal says it works great, so the code does function, but the person presenting it can't be bothered to show what it looks like. This is the unintended consequence of making code generation nearly free. The barrier to creating a polished-looking open-source project has dropped to approximately zero, and the barrier to creating a polished-looking open-source project that you actually understand has stayed exactly where it was. We're going to see more of this: repositories that are technically MIT-licensed, technically functional, technically open-source, but spiritually hollow. No maintainer who understands the code base, no one to review your pull request, no one to answer your issue. The Perlin noise math here is beautiful. It always has been. Ken Perlin won an Academy Award for it in 1997. The half-block rendering trick has been around for years in the terminal art community. These ideas deserve to be explored, extended, built upon by people who find them genuinely fascinating, not churned out as reputation farming for an account that didn't exist last week. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. That's supposed to be the point. Moving on. The Hacker News thread on this one is worth starting with because the comments cut right through the sentimentality. One commenter nails it. It's pretty amazing when you get the worst of both worlds. Total surveillance, yet still rampant crime. That's the tension nobody in Silicon Valley wants to sit with. Here's what happened. Amazon ran a Super Bowl ad for Ring's new search party feature. You upload a photo of your lost dog, and Ring activates other Ring cameras across your neighborhood, using AI to scan every animal that walks past every doorbell in range. Heart-tugging footage of kids reunited with puppies, and millions of Americans watched this and thought, wait, my doorbell camera is part of a networked surveillance grid. The backlash was immediate. People filmed themselves ripping Ring cameras off their walls. The EFF called it a preview of biometric identification unleashed from consumer devices to identify, track, and locate anything. Human, pet, or otherwise, Amazon had to kill a separate partnership with Flock Safety, a police surveillance company, just to stop the bleeding. The ad was supposed to sell cameras. Instead, it sold the public on exactly how much they should be afraid of their own hardware. Then the Guthrie case made it worse. Nancy Guthrie, Savannah Guthrie's mother, disappeared from her home in Tucson. She had Google Nest cameras, didn't pay for a subscription, and Google, the company that already had her footage, had automatically deleted it within hours. Gone, but here's the architectural question that matters. Google still had access to that video. The deletion wasn't because Google couldn't retain it. It was a business decision tied to a subscription tier. Your surveillance footage exists at the pleasure of a pricing page. Run this forward. Ring builds a distributed biometric scanning network and frames it as finding lost dogs. Google holds your security footage hostage behind a monthly fee. Both systems are closed. Both are controlled by companies whose actual customers are advertisers, not homeowners. The cameras point outward, but the data flows inward. To servers you don't control, under terms you didn't read, subject to law enforcement requests you'll never know about. One commenter called this a calculated move to normalize the technology. That framing is more generous than Amazon deserves. It assumes strategy where there might just be indifference. The architecture tells you everything. These aren't security tools, they're sensor networks with a consumer disguise. And the fact that it took a Super Bowl ad for millions of people to notice tells you exactly how well the disguise has been working. Moving on. I've spent enough time inside compilers and interpreters to know that the distance between simple and elegant is enormous. Forth sits on that line in a way almost nothing else does, and what this reverse engineering project reveals about Starflight is genuinely stunning from a craft perspective. The year is 1986, Binary Systems ships a game that lets you captain a starship across an open galaxy. Mining, diplomacy, combat. A slow-burning plot about ancient beings causing stars to flare. This is a sandbox game before the term existed. It influenced everything from Star Control to Mass Effect, and the entire thing was written in Forth. Now, fourth is the kind of language that makes you rethink what a programming language even is. The syntax is literally just spaces between words 2, 3, plus, dot. That's it. Stack machine, reverse Polish notation, no distinction between data and code. It's the programming equivalent of building a cathedral out of bricks and mortar. No steel frame, no prefab panels, just raw material and technique. Here's what the reverse engineering uncovered, and this is where it gets beautiful. The compiled executable is over 90% 16-bit pointers. Less than 5% is actual x86 assembly. The compiled code preserves the structure of the original fourth source. No optimization pass, no mangling, and 2,000 of the original 6,000-word names are still embedded in the binary, encrypted but recoverable. That's like finding the architect's original blueprints hidden inside the walls of a building, the fourth interpreter. Not just the compiled output, but the interactive interpreter itself is still in the executable. You can enable it. In 1986, they shipped a game with a live development environment baked into the binary. The inefficiency is real. The code wastes roughly half its CPU cycles just jumping between threaded word calls. But the elegance of the architecture is undeniable. And this project is fully open. The entire reverse engineering effort is on GitHub. The disassembly, the analysis, the recovered source structure. All of it available for anyone to study. Someone took a 40-year-old game, peeled back the layers, and documented how a small team of developers squeezed an entire galaxy out of indirect threading and a stack. The tools exist, the knowledge is available. This is exactly the kind of deep technical archaeology that deserves attention. Not because it ships a product, but because it illuminates how people solved hard problems with almost nothing. So what happens when you take that same spirit of building something extraordinary from scratch, pause, and point it at artificial intelligence? In 1986, Rodney Brooks published a paper called A Robust Layered Control System for a Mobile Robot that basically said, stop trying to build robots that think like philosophers. Give them bodies, ground them in the physical world. Let intelligence emerge from interaction with real environments, not from abstract symbol manipulation. It was controversial, it was right. And it took the field about 2 decades to fully absorb the lesson. RinBrain is what happens when that lesson meets modern foundation models, Alibaba's Demo Academy, just open-sourced and embodied AI system, 3 model sizes, 2B, 8B, and a 30B mixture of experts. That doesn't just process language or images in the abstract. It reasons about physical space. It looks at a scene through what they call egocentric understanding, meaning it processes video the way a body moving through a room would, not the way a surveillance camera does. It tracks objects, identifies graspable surfaces, infers motion trajectories, and plans sequences of physical actions. The architecture is worth looking at closely. They built on Qwen3 VL as a base, then trained extensively on what they call spatio-temporal and physical space data. The result is a model that can alternate between textual reasoning and spatial grounding. It thinks in words, then checks its thinking against actual geometry, then thinks again. Their chain-of-point reasoning system is particularly elegant. Instead of describing a scene and hoping downstream systems figure out the physics, it anchors every inference to specific coordinates in the visual field. When it plans a robot task, it doesn't say pick up the cup. It identifies the affordance location, the grasp point, the trajectory, and outputs instructions precise enough for a vision language action model to execute directly. The benchmarks show strong performance across embodied QA, object counting, navigation, and task planning. But benchmarks are benchmarks. What matters here is that every model checkpoint is on Hugging Face, every post-trained variant. The planner, the navigator, the chain of point reasoner is downloadable. The cookbooks walk through spatial understanding, object location, affordance detection, trajectory inference. The minimal dependency is literally one pip install. This is a foundational capability for robotics being placed directly into the commons. Anyone building autonomous systems from warehouse robots to assistive devices can start from these checkpoints instead of from scratch. The base models exist. The specialized variants exist. The documentation exists. Run this forward. Embodied intelligence shouldn't be something only 3 companies in the world can attempt. 8 stories in and we're still finding things that make us go, wait, really? Pause, this next one delivers. Let me make the strongest case for why this doesn't matter. It's a tiny Chinese Kickstarter company, maybe 25 devices online. The EEG data is noisy consumer-grade readings, not clinical diagnostics. Nobody's going to build a brain-computer exploit from a sleep mask sold to a few hundred backers. The responsible thing is to disclose patch, move on, small potatoes. Now let me explain why that argument collapses under its own weight. The vulnerability here isn't the scale, it's the architecture. Hard-coded credentials shared across every device connecting to a single MQTT broker with no access control. That's not a bug, that's a design philosophy. It says we need these devices to talk to our server, and the fastest way to ship is to bake one password into every unit. The moment you do that, you've made a decision that every user's data belongs to anyone who can decompile an APK. And in 2026, decompiling an APK is a conversation with Claude. That's the part worth sitting with. The reverse engineering here wasn't done by a security researcher with years of binary analysis experience. It was done by an LLM prompted by a curious user working through Bluetooth scanning, APK decompilation, Flutter binary string extraction, and protocol reconstruction in what reads like a single session. The skills bar for finding these vulnerabilities just dropped through the floor, which means every device shipping with hard-coded credentials, every IoT product that treats security as a post-launch concern, is now discoverable by anyone with a laptop and a subscription. And the EMS capability makes this more than a privacy story, sending electrical impulses to someone's face while they sleep, through a device they trusted enough to wear to bed. The attack surface isn't theoretical, the commands are documented, the broker is open. The deeper pattern here is what happens when you close the system. This company didn't publish their protocol, they didn't open their firmware. They shipped a compiled binary with secrets inside it, betting that obscurity would hold. It held for exactly as long as it took someone to ask an AI to look. Meanwhile, the user who found this had to build their own dashboard just to get reliable Bluetooth connectivity. If the protocol had been open from day one, the community would have found this vulnerability before the first unit shipped, and probably would have built better software for it too. Security through obscurity was always a bet against time. The odds just got a lot worse. We talked earlier about building tools the right way. Pause, here's a library that takes that philosophy to its beautiful minimal extreme. What does it actually take to build a web interface in 2026? The question sounds simple, but the answer has become extraordinarily complicated. We've constructed an entire civilization of build tools, bundlers, transpilers, framework-specific compilers, and dependency trees that would make a botanist weep. And somewhere underneath all of that machinery, HTML and CSS are still sitting there doing what they were designed to do, waiting for someone to notice. OAT is 8 kilobytes, total CSS and JavaScript combined. You drop 2 files into your project and you have a component library, no NPM install, no framework, no build step, no node modules folder consuming half your disk. You write semantic HTML, the kind the web was actually designed around. And it looks good out of the box because the styles target the elements themselves, not an endless taxonomy of class names. This is worth putting in historical context. In 1996, the CSS Zen Garden demonstrated that a single HTML document could look completely different with nothing but style sheet changes. The whole point was that semantic markup and presentation were separate concerns. Somewhere in the last decade, we collectively forgot that lesson. We started writing div soup with 30 utility classes per element, building component trees that compile to markup that a browser could have rendered natively, and calling it progress. The Hacker News comments on this one split predictably. Someone points out it's a 5-day-old repo with 2,000 GitHub stars and questions the organic enthusiasm. Fair enough. Astroturfing happens, but the substance stands on its own. Another commenter nails it by comparing this to what they expected from Daisy UI but didn't get, and suggests pairing it with Datastar to stay on actual web standards rather than framework ecosystems. That's the instinct worth following. The web platform in 2026 is genuinely powerful. CSS grid, custom properties, container queries, the dialogue element, details and summary, native web components. The primitives are there. Libraries like OAT aren't revolutionary. They're a reminder. The browser already knows how to do most of what we keep rebuilding from scratch. 8 kilobytes. That's not a limitation. That's a proof of concept for what the platform can do when you stop fighting it. Moving on. Constraint propagation is one of those ideas that sounds academic until you watch it solve a real problem in front of you. Eli's post walks through how Bicross generates its Picross puzzles, and the core technique is beautiful in its simplicity. Here's the setup. You generate a random grid, calculate the row and column hints from it, then throw the grid away. Now you hand those hints to a solver and ask, can you reconstruct the original grid using only logic? No guessing, no backtracking, pure deduction. The solver works by computing every valid arrangement for each row and column, then stacking them up. If a cell is filled in every single valid permutation, it must be filled. If it's empty in every permutation, it must be empty. That's your intersection step. Then you prune. If row 0 forces cell 3 to be filled, go to column 3's permutation list and delete any arrangement that doesn't agree. Loop until you converge or get stuck. What makes this elegant is the acceptance criteria. If the solver gets stuck, if there are cells, it can't determine through pure constraint propagation. The puzzle gets rejected, generate a new one. This guarantees every puzzle a player encounters is solvable without guessing. That's a contract between the game and the player enforced by math. Run this forward to game design generally. How many procedurally generated games ask players to make decisions without giving them enough information to reason? Constraint propagation gives you a formal answer to, is this fair? You generate, you test, you accept or reject. The computational cost is front-loaded at generation time, so the player never pays it. The whole post is open, the technique is well documented, and the code is right there in the Bicross source. Someone building a puzzle game next week can pick this up and use it. That's how knowledge is supposed to work. You figure something out, you write it down, you put it where people can reach it. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 15th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated, scripts by Claude Opus 4.6, voice by Quen3TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go make something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.